Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, July 11th, 2025. I'm Brianne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares with you the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. This week on Rabble Radio, Rabble editor Nick Seabrook speaks with Dr. Yi Peng Ji, one of over 4,000 people from around the world who joined the Global March to Gaza. The Global March to Gaza attempted to reach the Rafah border crossing between Egypt and Palestine, aiming to draw global attention to the blockade of Gaza and call for an end to the siege. Here are Nick Seabrook and Yi Peng Ji in conversation. Take a listen.
Dr. Ji, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So I guess to get started, can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and your background?
Yeah, for sure. So I'm a family doctor and have also been trained in public health, understanding the impacts of structural determinants of health, things like colonialism and how that affects people's health here in the context of Canada, the settler colonial context of Canada. And I've also studied the health of Palestinians in the context of occupied Palestine, understanding the impacts of colonialism as it affects health there as well. And I am calling in from the unceded, unsurrendered territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabeg, also known as Ottawa, and that's where I also work as a family doctor.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And can you tell us a little bit about the Global March to Gaza and what that was?
Yeah, the Global March to Gaza was a people, citizen, volunteer-led effort that happened a few weeks ago, where over 4,000 people from 80 different countries went to Cairo, Egypt, to attempt to march to the Rafah border to bring international attention and pressure to the ongoing blockade and siege held by the Israelis, aided and abetted by other countries like Egypt, to deny essential humanitarian aid like food, medicine, water, baby formula to the entirety of the Gaza Strip. This happened in the context of multiple freedom flotillas that were also attempting to bring aid into Gaza by sea. The next one actually departing in a few days on the 13th of July. And this also was in the context of the Tunisian Samoud convoy that left Tunisia, attempted to move by land with a convoy of over 150 cars and trucks with, I think, around 2,000 people. They were stopped in eastern Libya before they could enter Egypt. And we just saw all of these people-led efforts be quashed by states that are complicit in allowing Israel to continue its genocide and also allowing the blockade to kind of continue, the famine to continue.
Now, Rabble, we covered a press conference that you participated in on Parliament Hill just before you left for the Global March to Gaza. Was this march something that came together fairly quickly or had been in the works for a while?
It was something that I think was being planned fairly quickly, but it was something that was being kind of managed by the organizers for at least a couple of months. But I know many of the participants signed up fairly last minute because there was a degree of skepticism of like, was this going to be possible? Like myself, I signed up to join as a participant around a week before the march began. So it was a very last minute decision to join. And I think because it was, you know, a lot of people were skeptical of, were we going to be able to do it? Unfortunately, we were not successful in marching to the Rafah border crossing because the Egyptian authorities really stopped everyone, even at the airport coming in. People were detained and arrested and deported. And even just attempting to gather in Cairo or in Ismailia was really challenging. This was even before the Egyptian Sinai, which would require Egyptian authority approval. So the planning of it, I think, was fairly extensive. I wasn't part of the organizing committee myself, but I know that there's also many efforts now to build on the momentum of what had taken place in Egypt, taken place in Tunisia, to build on a Samoud flotilla kind of effort so that Many different people who have been mobilized will continue to mobilize as to do what they can to kind of bring aid into Gaza through the sea.
Now, obviously, participating some in something like this is, there was risk involved. It's a significant commitment of time and resources on your part. Why did you feel it was important for you to participate in this march?
I think personally for myself, as someone who's studied the impacts of colonialism on health in the context of Canada affecting Indigenous First Nations Inuit Métis peoples, that's what led me to the question of Palestine. And having also witnessed the conditions of apartheid and occupation in the West Bank, and then having volunteered in primary care clinics as a medical volunteer in central Rafah in Gaza during this genocide, I know that the solution for the people of Palestine is ultimately liberation. And it's through these meaningful solidarity efforts to end the siege and the blockade and the occupation and the genocide. This is the solution. Like it is international solidarity efforts in coordination and in direction with what Palestinian voices and narratives are telling us from the ground to be able to use all the mechanisms necessary within our toolbox to be in full solidarity with the Palestinian people to end the conditions of occupation and genocide and apartheid. And we really take that kind of direction with seriousness and with a strong conviction for what we need to do in this moment. And we need to do everything to be able to prevent and end genocide. We've utterly failed as an international community with the obligation really on states, on different states around the world to end and prevent genocide, but that has utterly failed the people of Palestine because of those systems of oppression, namely Zionist colonialism, imperialism, and capitalism that make this genocide a profitable one. But the people of conscience around the world, I think, refuse to put profits over people, to put these interests above the people's right to self-determination, liberation, dignity, the right to life. And so, in understanding this, when we have that privilege and that opportunity and the resources to contribute to a solidarity movement in this way, I think it means that we must. And so, it just became really clear to me that this was something that I needed to do, not only for the people of Palestine, but also for myself, right? I think people have said, do you really think that you folks, or like you as a person, can change the world? And one of the things I think back on is some other people have also reflected on this. It's not about changing the world per se. It's also not letting the world change us and the ways in which we see the world and the values and principles and the morals that we have. And so we will continue to mobilize and organize to do what we can for the people of Palestine as they experience an ongoing genocide. But we also know that the liberation of Palestine and for Palestinians also comes from their actions, their resistance, their resilience, their steadfastness on the ground. But it doesn't absolve us of the responsibility in the West, in particular, when our states, our governments are the most complicit in this genocide, as they, for example, Canada continues to send arms and weapons, normalize relations with Israel, and continues to provide diplomatic and political cover for Israel.
Now, for you mentioned hostility that you experienced on the ground in Egypt. People who followed you on social media could see that this came both from official government representatives as well as regular Egyptian people on the ground who were hostile to people trying to get to the Rafah border crossing. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that entailed whenever you got to Egypt, what that was like and what you experienced?
So some of the people that were participating in the march, but also others that were not participating in the march, but looked like they might have been because they were foreigners or they looked like foreigners, were caught up in this frenzy of the Egyptian authorities trying to identify who they assumed or suspected to be a part of the march, and essentially arrested, detained, and deported a lot of people. This happened at the airport where some people and delegations didn't even make it out of the airport and they were deported back to their country of departure. And others made it to their hotels in downtown Cairo, for example, and then they were rounded up in their hotels and detained and then later deported from the airport. Those others that managed to find their way into Cairo because they could not stop everyone, we tried to gather in Ismailia, which is a couple kilometers away from central Cairo. The drive is, not too far. It's about like 30 minutes to 40 minutes, I think. But there's a few different checkpoints. They're essentially toll booths, not actually formal military checkpoints, between Cairo and Ismailia. And at multiple checkpoints, people were stopped with their passports confiscated, and some were told to get your passport back. You have to agree to go to the airport and be deported, essentially. And so that was the day of trying to gather as a group. And at the first checkpoint, there were approximately 300, 400 people, to my understanding, that were stopped. And then the second checkpoint, there were upwards, if not more than 1,000 people that were stopped. And I was stopped at the second checkpoint with many others. And later, what we had experienced after most people's passports were given back was there were agitators, and there were news reports of these being paid agitators that came and disrupted the group, attacked the people that were still there at the second checkpoint, forcing them onto buses so that they would go back to central Cairo, some of whom were deported, some of whom were held on buses for upwards of 12 hours. My friends who actually made it to Ismailia, they were rounded up from the streets of Ismailia, from a cafe on their way to a hotel, being suspected of being a part of the march, and they were essentially detained on these buses for over 12 hours, all to kind of intimidate, all to dissuade people from gathering as a group, to really show and demonstrate the people power of the people who stand in solidarity with Palestine.
Now, a question about that hostility from Egypt. Egypt is an Arab state, Libya, another Arab state, both authoritarian governments. Why are they preventing activists like yourself from trying to get to the Rafah border crossing? What is their interest in helping to support Israel?
There's a lot of different ways I think to look at this. I mean, the very obvious reason is we think about where the borders of Zionism really lie in the region, and Zionist, like settler colonialism as a process, doesn't happen within a vacuum. Genocide and apartheid doesn't happen within a vacuum. If the countries and states around the region truly saw what was happening as wrong, and they wanted to take action to end that, they have many different levers at their disposal to do that. But they are ultimately collaborators in what Israel is doing through these kinds of normalized diplomatic political relations. And what happened in the days, in the immediate day before the march really began, was an Israeli minister, I believe it was like the interior minister or something like that, basically said Egypt cannot allow this march to happen. And that communication obviously was taken quite seriously by the Egyptian authorities at the highest levels, and that was what was communicated down to the police officers that were detaining and arresting people with no good reason. I remember one of my friends who was caught up in this 12-hour detainment on the bus, and he asked the police officer, "What did we do wrong? What laws did we break?" And basically, they said none. And that's also why they were ultimately released after the 12 hours, I think. And they were just told, "We're following orders, right? We're just doing our job. We're following orders." And we have to understand that, for example, Egypt, the broader kind of like political, social context of what's happened over the past 20, 21 months as well. There have been students, activists, journalists who have been detained because of just trying to organize something for Palestine. Some of these people, tens of thousands of political prisoners for many different reasons, but some of them try to organize things for Palestine, even on their own student campuses in Egypt, and are still being held by the Egyptian authorities. And then the list kind of goes on, where the Egyptian Hala Company charged thousands of dollars for Palestinians from Gaza who wanted to exit Gaza. And then those that exited for medical evacuation reasons find themselves in Egyptian hospitals and receiving extremely substandard care. I've even visited some of these patients in the Egyptian hospitals, and they express that they want to even go back to Gaza, knowing the conditions in Gaza. Despite knowing those conditions, they would rather go back because of the conditions in these Egyptian hospitals. And then you have the many tens of thousands of Palestinians who are now displaced in Egypt, who voluntarily left through paying the Egyptian Hala Company, for example, and not having papers to be able to work or study. And so the layers of kind of this oppression of Palestinians in Egypt is, yet another kind of example of how these countries in the region, these states around Israel, do collaborate in the systemic oppression of Palestinians.
For Canada, we talked about the Canadian government. What is the Canadian government's responsibility here? What do you want to see the Canadian government do in response to the ongoing genocide in Gaza?
There's so many groups that have articulated this for almost 2 years now, right? And actually, many groups have raised the alarm bells for a slow genocide that was happening in Palestine because of the occupation and apartheid conditions that many human rights organizations had previously already raised the alarm bells around, which Canada has an obligation under international law to prevent and end genocide. Full stop. And Canada has actually refused to do so by continuing to send arms to Israel, whether it be direct trade or through other companies, Canadian companies that are sending parts to the US for building warfare technology that are later sent to Israel to bomb Palestinians. And a very easy example is GasStops, a Canadian Ottawa-based manufacturing company that creates the engine sensors that fits into the F-35 fighter jets built in the US by Lockheed Martin and then sent to Israel for Israel to fly those planes over Gaza to drop 2,000-pound bombs on a largely civilian population. And so the least that Canada can do, and actually in obligation under their own kind of international pieces of legislation that they signed, is to end those arms trades, to actually put in a meaningful two-way arms embargo. There are other things that Canada can and should do that I think also align with these obligations, which is cancel free trade. Canada still has an ongoing trade agreement with Israel. Sanctions, meaningful sanctions on the Israeli war cabinet, the Israeli government that are committing these atrocities, these war crimes, these crimes that are being investigated by the International Court of Justice, by the International Criminal Court. And there are other things that Canada can also do, which is prosecute dual national citizens, that there are Canadians that have participated in these war crimes and crimes against humanity and genocide being perpetrated by the Israeli military. And so these individuals should be prosecuted under Canadian law and jurisdiction for their involvement in the genocide. And of course, this is not a solution. Like, humanitarian aid is not a solution, because what ultimately Palestinians need is, a sovereign, self-determined healthcare system led by the people and for the people. But in the meantime, it is not to undermine the existing humanitarian system, but that has continuously been undermined over the past 2 years, is to properly fund, the WHO, the United Nations, UNRWA, to be able to deliver humanitarian aid in a way that is meaningful. But for the past months now, we've seen a decimation of that system by Israel and by the US to create something called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which is delivering scarce amounts of food aid by American mercenaries. And then Israeli gunshot fire has killed many, many people, massacred people in the hundreds, sometimes on a daily basis at these so-called aid distribution sites, after they have completely decimated the existing humanitarian aid delivery framework in the Gaza Strip, largely coordinated by the United Nations. And so, if Canada cares about an international world order post the creation of the United Nations, Canada has to meaningfully stand up and use its diplomatic and political levers to pressure Israel to stop what it's doing. And there was a recent letter, I believe, coordinated by Norway around support for the ICC and its jurisdiction to do their work independently. And Canada applauds themselves about its role in the creation of the ICC and yet didn't even sign on to this letter that was presented at Human Rights Council at the United Nations just, I believe, a week or so ago. And so we see the ways in which Canada continues to really undermine its own obligations and its clear double standards around maintaining a sense of humanity and morality in this world. But you know, in some ways, it's clear to me that Canada is also doing what it's always done. Canada is a settler colonial state that has committed and continues to commit genocide on this land in many different forms now. And with that kind of colonial interest in mind, it continues to uphold a colonial outpost in the region, being Israel, to and those interests are in alignment still continuously because of those interests of capital and colonial and imperial interests that there are Canadian companies, for example, that profit generously because of the genocide, because of conflict, because of war is just so awfully profitable, largely because of the American military industrial complex being so tied with Canada's companies as well.
Now that you've returned to Canada after the march, we're seeing the genocide in Gaza continue. We're seeing countries like the US and Israel continue to undermine these international institutions that you've been talking about just this week. Francesca Albanese, the special rapporteur for the UN on Gaza, was sanctioned by the US. My question is, what are the next steps here for you as an activist on this issue and for those who want to get involved and make a difference, what do we do next?
You know, there's so much to do. I think ultimately we have to pick things that make sense strategically, that put our energy and time into things that will effectively move something forward in a meaningful way. And to do that requires collective efforts, requires working with other people to really address some of those pain points in moving the dial towards Palestinian liberation. I really look towards the boycott, divestment, BDS movement that recently passed its 20-year anniversary. A movement led by Palestinian civil society as a peaceful, nonviolent movement for what's been tried and true to end apartheid, for example, in South Africa, and to use these ways to kind of educate others about the ties in which companies, workplaces, grocery stores, pension plans, academic institutions has ties in normalizing an apartheid state committing genocide. Like, let that be a window of opportunity to welcome people into a broader movement for liberation for Palestinians, and to do the collective action that is necessary, whether it be through ending that complicity in your workplace, through your union, through your pension plan, through your academic institutions. You know, so whatever we do, it has to be strategic, it has to be targeted, it has to be effective in the ways that can also help build a movement so that it's sustainable. You know, colonialism in the West was not built overnight, and so we have to, I think, temper our efforts to be sustainable so that we will work towards dismantling these forms of oppression over a long period of time, inviting many more people into the movement. I will be attending the Freedom Flotilla launch in southern Italy in a few days because the Handola boat is taking off from southern Italy on July 13th as another effort to break the siege. But there are so many different movements all around us. And it's just picking something, spending time and energy on it, building the connections and the relationships necessary so that we can continue this struggle sustainably for the long term.
All right. And there's so much more to say on this issue, but unfortunately, we're at the end of our time. Dr. Yiping Ji, thank you so much for your work on this matter. Thank you so much for your advocacy, and thank you for taking the time to speak with us today about it.
Thank you for having me, Nick. Appreciate it.
That was Dr. Yipeng Ji in conversation with Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. You can read Ji's full reflections on the march in his op-ed on rabble.ca. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on rabble.ca. For that, let's go back over to Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting this week in labor news. Workers at one of Canada's most recognizable and popular tourist destinations have been locked out by their employer. About 250 workers at Toronto's famous CN Tower have been locked out since Monday, June 30th. The workers, represented by Unifor Local 4271, have been negotiating a new collective agreement with their employer, the Canada Lands Corporation. CN Tower workers, which includes front house hosts, wait staff, and bartenders, have not had their pension plan benefits increased in 15 years. They are also seeking an increase in pay. Canada Lands said prior to making the decision to lock out their unionized employees that they had been negotiating in good faith. Unifor, however, says the corporation has not addressed their members' key concerns. Staying with labor news, union members represented by the Ontario Compensation Employees Union have reached and approved a new collective agreement with their employer, the Workplace Safety and Insurance Board. Employees of the WSIB have been on strike for more than a month. The two parties agreed to a 7% wage increase over 3 years. As well, the WSIB promised to address workload concerns by forming a committee to look at the issue. And finally, Ontario Premier Doug Ford has ordered a review of the Ontario Municipal Employees Retirement System, a defined benefit pension plan for municipal workers. In an op-ed for rabble.ca, Paul Kinnert warns that the Ford government might be seeking to meddle in the pension plan for political reasons. In the 1990s, a previous Conservative Premier, Mike Harris, gave employers a 4-year holiday from contributing to the plan. Kinnert explained that the Ontario Municipal Employees Retirement System is a well-run, fiscally solvent, defined benefit plan, and that by potentially weakening it, Doug Ford hopes to create an opportunity for the province to step in and take it over. As always, you can read the full version of all the stories we talked about today on rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.